Welcome to the Healing for Male Survivors podcast. This is a podcast for male survivors of sexual abuse and assault, whether as a child or as an adult. Know that you are not alone and the abuse was not your fault. My name is Mike Chapman. I'm a certified recovery life coach and also a survivor. Let's find hope and healing together. And welcome to the Healing for Male Survivors podcast. This is Mike Chapman. I'm a recovery life coach with Polar Life Consulting. And with me today, I have our special guest, Craig Heiding, who is a survivor of childhood sexual abuse and an experienced media executive leading two startup companies to successful events, one being purchased and one an IPO. Along with his daughter, Craig wrote a stage play called Guilt about the implications of keeping one's abuse hidden from their loved ones and themselves. Craig helped found the men's division of VoicesBeyondAssault.org and serves as its co-chair, hosting a monthly program, podcast, and video podcast, spotlighting survivors and therapists in an effort to shed light and educate others about male CSA. And also serves as a board member of the nonprofit organization. Craig has four children and resides in the Los Angeles area with his wife, Janie. And we'll learn more about Craig in a moment. I'll remind you, we are live. And if you would like to join us on this live podcast, you can find details at polarlifeconsulting.com/live. And you can join in chat. For those who are here as guests, feel free to add any questions you might have to the Q&A section, and we will only state your name if you type that manually in the text. Otherwise, we will just say an audience member. So with that, let's get to know Craig a little better, where we share the part of our show called Four Questions. Now it's time for Four Questions, that part of the podcast when we get to know our guest a bit better by asking a few questions. Let's go.
I feel like I'm on a game show.
I know. Well, it's like to keep it peppy. I love that theme music. Keep it positive, because we talk about so many heavy things, but we don't have to be heavy people. We can be a little goofy and be a little silly. And I love this section of the podcast. It gets to know our guests more as a real live three-dimensional human being instead of just a case file, if you will. So what is your favorite food memory?
Well, I think that would have to be, I was raised in Wisconsin, and when I was young, I would go up to my cousin's house who grew corn for Green Giant in her farm. And
Green Giant.
Yeah, we would have the most amazing sweet corn that I still cannot find. I live in California now, and you can't find good sweet corn here. I'm sorry. It's just nothing like that.
Right, especially fresh off the farm, and they grow it professionally, so they know what they're doing. And yes, nothing beats fresh corn for sure. Interesting. Yeah, I love that.
We used to have entire meals just sweet corn on your plate. Oh. You would have like four or five cobs, and that was it.
Right. Wow. Yes, that's great. Yeah, I do like corn. Corn, as I've gotten older, corn doesn't like me very much, unfortunately, but I do like to eat it, especially Mexican street corn. That's one of my favorites. So what is your favorite Christmas or holiday memory?
Well, when my kids were little, one Christmas, we arranged, and we didn't tell them that we were going to take them to Disney World in Florida. So we had all their bags packed, and when they opened their gifts, they were little clues that were like, Santa on a surfboard, and those globes and different things that we had as clues to Florida. And then they found out that the car was picking us up in just minutes, and they were just getting right out into the car and getting on the plane and going to Disney World in Florida. So that was That was really fun.
Good job, Dad. That's nice.
Yeah. Christmas is always my favorite.
Yeah, me too. Excellent. I love that story. So what is your favorite church or house of worship memory?
When I was young, I was raised Catholic, and I remember that I went to see this play called Godspell. And it was the first time that Jesus became like a real person to me, like a real someone that I could relate to, that was my friend, that was my brother, that was my savior. It was quite an amazing experience. So later on, when I got to a church, I met some folks at the church, and I said, I would love to direct the musical Godspell. And I did it for 10 years. I did it for 10 years at that church. And every year we did it, every year we sold out. It's the Gospel According to Matthew, my favorite, obviously my favorite book in the Gospel now, but it's very special, and Godspell was what brought it. Have you ever seen it?
Trying to remember. I've seen Jesus Christ Superstar. I don't know if we've seen Godspell. I know my wife likes both of them, and it's just,
they always wanted me to do Jesus Christ Superstar, and I just didn't get it. But Godspell is really takes the Gospel According to Matthew, and he teaches his disciples the parables in a funny way. They're all, they add humor to it, but it gets the message across. And to this day, when I hear the gospel and I hear one of those gospels, I always like, yeah, I remember the scene.
Oh, nice. That's one of my wife's favorite movies, and I don't remember if I've seen it or not. Yeah, definitely put that on the list. Next question. What is your favorite scripture or any inspirational quote that has helped you on your spiritual journey, and what about it speaks to you?
So, I'm not great at memorizing scripture, but I memorize stories, and the Good Samaritan is always one that resonates with me the most, because people were just passing this person by that needed help. One of the things that somebody said to me once, I think it was a Jesuit priest in college, said, I went to a Jesuit school, and he said, anyone who asks you for help could be Jesus asking you for help. It could be Jesus. And you don't know. And so you have to be prepared. And so I've always remembered that. And I can never pass anybody by. It's not always popular with my wife, but I have trouble passing anybody by that needs help.
Right. And I think that's why Jesus spoke in parables so often, because, I mean, the culture of man is to tell stories, and those stories get passed on. And the power of story, and that's kind of the theme of my podcast, is the power of story. And Jesus definitely knew how to use that to full advantage to help people remember those lessons by telling those stories. Yeah, that's great. Which, great segue into, let me hear about your story. And I know my story bounces all over the timeline because that's how my story unfolded. So start wherever you need to start. Then after you tell your story, then I want to know more about your healing journey as well. And then we'll go into what you're doing these days.
So we were from Milwaukee, and we moved out to the suburbs when I had just started first grade. And so I would have been about 6 years old. I had trouble making friends. My brother was 6 years older than me, so he was off doing his own thing. I was very small and very slight, young looking always. And so I had trouble, but we had these neighbors, and they were like three boys, and one of them was my brother's age, another one was in the middle, and then there was the youngest one, which was about 3-4 years older than me. They would always play baseball, play basketball, but I was so much younger, I wasn't good, but they would call me names and you know, say that, you know, you're lame, you're terrible words that were depicting things like sexuality, you know, you're
right,
different things, and it made me, it was very sad. But the one that was like 3 or 4 years older than me, he would be very nice to me, when they weren't around. And he would be like the only, the first person that was in this new home, that was this new family life that was nice to me.
This is the younger of the three.
He was the younger of the three brothers. Yeah. Except when we were with them, then he would turn on me again. And it was just so confusing for me. But I just longed to be around him when he was nice to me, because here was this older guy that was, I thought he was cool, and he was, you know, he was really nice to me. And he started to be a little more and more controlling as we got a little older. He would come over and I feel like I'd have to go with him, and I'd have to do whatever he said. And it was all part of, now I know, the grooming process. One day we were in his basement playing pool, I felt his hands come up behind me and choke me. I blacked out. I passed out. And when I woke up, he apparently dragged me into his father's workshop, which is also downstairs. And I didn't know what he was doing. I kind of looked up a little bit, and I didn't know where I was. And I could see his head bobbing up and down. I was like, what is going on? But I was afraid to stay because I didn't want to be choked again. Then he was finished with whatever he was, you know, whatever. I don't know what a 9-year-old can satisfy a person like that. But he was finished and he left. And he left me to pull up my pants and wonder what was going on. And it happened again and again and again and again. And every time he would choke me, I would pass out, until I decided I needed to figure out a better way to do this. So I got to the point where I would just pretend that, you know, as soon as he put his hands around my neck, I would pretend to be passed out. And then he would drag me. And this happened not only in his basement, outside, walking home from school. He would jump out from places. The family had a key to our house because they were neighbors, and they took care of me when my parents were working. And he would jump out. He couldn't take a shower. I was attacked in the shower. He would hide under my bed. Come out of a closet. It was just like I wasn't safe at all. Even when I was a little bit older, I worked at you could do that at 12, you could start working. I was working at selling Christmas trees, and I was locking up at night, and he attacked me there even. And I was always so afraid that someone was going to catch us, because even though I wasn't doing anything, I thought that they would think that it was me that was doing it and that was my fault. And I got to know that this was not normal, what he was doing, but I didn't know how to stop it. And I started to learn, you know, hear things about things going on. And when I was 12, this altar boy that I was an altar boy with, he was caught in bed with a priest, with our parish priest. And everybody was talking about it. Everybody was talking about it. And this was, you know, he was having sex with the priest. And I still wasn't sure what sex was. My idea of sex was what was going on with me, right? So I thought that's what was happening to this boy. Obviously, I thought that's it, right? The priest was doing whatever my abuser was doing to me. So I decided I was going to tell my parents, and this was a good time to tell them what was going on so I could stop this, because I didn't like it. I was terrified all the time of going into any room, dark or anything. I couldn't be alone.
Right.
So I walked down the hallway, I remember, and I heard my parents talking about this altar boy, and they said, well, he must have done something to make father do that to him. And
victim blaming.
I just turned around and walked back into my room. About 3 weeks later, I hung myself in the basement.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, this is where I get kind of spiritual. So before that, I didn't come out from downstairs. We had a rec room, and I would just rock in the rocking chair, and I would just, and my only friend was God. Jesus was my only person that knew what was going on with me, and what kind of emptiness and despair I was in. But I knew that telling yourself was a sin, right? That's what I was taught.
Right.
But I thought this was the only way I could end it. So I tied a bunch of clothes together in the laundry room and you know, picked the chair dangling, blacked out. I was used to that. So obviously, you know, I mean, it was weird that I picked a way that you know, was my abuser was doing to me, which is I didn't realize until later was kind of strange.
Right.
But then miraculously, I've had it tied to a doorknob, and the doorknob broke off, like it just like came off, and I went crashing to the ground. You know, I immediately caught my breath, I came to, and like pulled the noose off my neck, and I decided then and there that I was going to figure out a way to stop it and take my life back. It took me 2 years, but it was on my 14th birthday, and by now he was my pretty much my caretaker. He was now 18 or 19, and he called
your older brother, not the neighbor boy. Was your caretaker?
No, my older brother was nowhere. He was never my caretaker. The older boy was my caretaker. My brother was married. He left the house and was married at 18, and he was pretty much not really a part of my life. He didn't really want much to do with his younger brother. You know, I just kind of dragged him down, right? So he wasn't really in the picture, but I came home from school and I was alone again because my parents were working, and the phone rang and I answered it. I knew it was him, but he didn't say it was him, but he said, "I'm going to come over and kill you right now." So I just got the biggest butcher knife that I could find, and I sat at the kitchen table where I could see both doors because he had a key. And he came in and I stood up, and by now I've grown a little bit, so I'm not so much smaller than him. I'm actually maybe still like 5-6 inches smaller, but I just held up the knife and I said, I may die and I don't care if I die, but you are not going to get out of here unhurt. And it was the very first time that I ever even confronted him about what was going on, because I had always pretended to be passed out. So this was quite a big deal that I said, "You're not going to come near me again." And he turned around and he walked away and left. And I didn't see him again until years later. Mm. And that was the end of it. That was the end of it. So I decided that I was never going to tell a single soul. And I was never going to think about it or talk about it ever again. So I went and did what a lot of male survivors do. I went and became an overachiever. I was just going into high school. I became the captain of the swim team. I was the editor of the school newspaper, very popular. I was in the homecoming court. I had a lot, like I would have girlfriends, because I was overdoing that as well, because I wanted to prove to myself that I didn't think I was gay. So I didn't want to be labeled that. So I was trying to prove that. That seemed to go very well for me for most of my life, except when I got to college, the first thing I'm assigned as a story is a boy who jumps out of the window on the top floor of a dorm. I didn't know then, but it was that he was being abused sexually by his counselor, who was also a priest. I didn't know that, but it was quite traumatic covering that. My friend, who I became really best friends with, was the editor of the newspaper. He was the news editor, and I was just a reporter at that time. And we became best friends, and I never had a best friend before. And it was pretty cool because we were inseparable. We just, you know, and his dad had died when he was young. He was, you know, just raised by his mom, but we just really hit it off well. We were both swimmers, so that was really fun too. But then, you know, and I was going along being Mr. Popular, Mr. Overachiever, and one night we were coming back from a basketball game. We're in a park, and we stopped, and he said he had to tell me something, and he told me that his mentor, who is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the newspaper, the main newspaper in the city, had raped him. And he went over to this guy's house all the time, but the guy's wife was gone, and he took the opportunity to get him drunk and rape him. And I couldn't handle it. I was so freaked out that if I even tried to console him or tried to understand what was going on with him, that my secret would be out and my life would be over. All the things that I worked for in the last 6 years previous to that would be gone. And right. I convinced myself of that, and I panicked, and I couldn't help him. I couldn't stay there. I just left. He begged me to stay. I couldn't. I said, I can't hear it. And he killed himself. And that's what, that's what my play is about. So I went on and moved to California, just dated like crazy. Then, had a scare of one of the girls that I was with, said she was pregnant, and I freaked out and I said, I'm going to be celibate. This Irish girl from New York who I fell in love with. We're still married today, 37 years later.
Wow. And, good for you. Yeah. Also married an Irish girl and 33 years. So, yeah.
We had four kids, and I never told her anything about the abuse. One time we were in a store in Milwaukee, and we had our kids, and I saw him, and I froze. I froze, and she knows me well.
You saw the neighbor boy.
I saw him, yeah, and I just froze, and she's like, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I just said that guy over there was mean to me when I was a little kid, and he didn't know that it had anything to do with sexual abuse, but she was like, I'm going over there to get it. I'm like, no, please don't do that. And I had to beg her not to do that because she's from New York, you know, an Irish woman. She doesn't hold anything back. So that happened. I thought I was over it. I thought I was good. I was healed. I had put it behind me. And then, like happens with a lot of survivors, it happened again. Until they get healing, you know, you're still a victim. And I don't know how that happens. I used to think I had this mark on my forehead when I was like 33 years old. The head of our legal department for our company got me really drunk at an event, and then said, well, I'll take you to where you have to go, and really just took me to a closet and tried to abuse me. I was too drunk to really give him a lot of pleasure. I don't know how, if it was. But it happened again, and that just destroyed me. I pulled away from my wife. I didn't have relations with her again, and because I felt that I was marked, and it was the end. And of course, my wife thought it was her, right? That I wasn't in love with her. But we had four kids by then, and so we stuck it out. And I tried, and I did have bouts where I could, you know, be a husband. But I was a good father. I was too good of a father. I mean, I didn't let those kids out of my sight. They couldn't go on sleepovers. That kind of pulled us apart a little bit. We stuck together, but because we're soulmates, but we had a lot of difficulties. And about 7 years ago, actually, so this it happened again. This friend of mine, who was also a client, we were out in another city and got really drunk, and he was drunker than I was, and he couldn't drive. So I said, look, I have a 2-bedroom suite. You stay in the other bedroom in my hotel. So he did that. I woke up in the middle of the night, and he was trying to do something with me. And I freaked out. And I've known this person for like 10 years and never had any idea. And I just freaked out. He told me him and his wife were having problems. And I said, okay, so let's just pretend this never happened. But then he texted me and said, I'd like to sleep with you again. And my daughter saw it because my phone's always out. Like, what is this? And I had a nervous breakdown. I just completely lost it. My secret is out. I ran barefoot out of the house with no shirt, just shorts. Fell asleep passed out underneath a park bench the next day. And as soon as I came to, I realized that I needed help, that I needed to come clean. I needed to tell my wife what happened to me, all of it. I needed to find a way to get past this. It was a huge weight off my shoulders telling her, but then she immediately went into save me mode, and we tried to find people to help me. And I didn't know where to look. And so we started going to online and typing in, you know, male abuse survivor therapists. And I would go to one after the other. And The first one, he said, you know, you're 50 years old, you're over 50, you should be over this by now. And then I left that one. The next one puts me in a room to take cognitive tests with, and there was all these other boys around me, and all I could do is think that they were also abused, and I ran out of there. So finally, I mean, wow. After like this, like five or six of these, I got this call from this guy, and he goes, so do you want to try seeing me, today? I can see you today. And I went, and I'm like, I walked in there, and he's like, so young. And I said, how old are you? Are you sure you even have your license? And he goes, I'm 32. And I'm like, He said, is that going to be a problem? And I said, well, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, how much do you really know about this? I need somebody. But you know what? You're the first one who's even offered to help me. So I'm going to take, and he's been my therapist ever since, for the last 6 years. Wow. and 6.5 years. And I see him less now, but we still stay in touch. Right. And he's actually a prominent character in my play. And it's almost verbatim of like how we met. It's been a quite a journey. And I saw things when I remember the first time, I thought I was still alone. I mean, I think when you tell your story for the first time, you feel even more alone. I remember watching Leaving Neverland, which I know is important to you too. I cried and cried, but I also knew that those two guys were telling the truth. Right. I think that survivors know that other survivors are telling the truth. At this point, by the way, I wasn't calling myself a survivor yet. I was still thinking of myself as a victim. Then I saw Oprah Winfrey, and I was like, now I was in love with her because she did this thing that was so amazing, because I know she had Michael Jackson on her program earlier. She, when he was alive, and I know this was hard for her, and I also know that she's a survivor herself. And it was right. quite incredible. And I hadn't seen the show. I never knew. Honestly, if you would have asked me 7 years ago if I were ever abused sexually as a kid, I would have said no, of course not.
Right.
I would have said no, because I was in such denial. But it all just kind of came to, and then also what happened simultaneously with all of this is a list came out of the priests, and it was found out that this priest molested this kid who jumped out of the dorm, and that I had covered. And I remember I covered this. He was black, and there weren't that many black kids in my school. And there was a letter that was written that Wally, his name was Wally, he wrote before he jumped out of the window. It was 13 stories high. There was a letter he wrote, and it said, "Dear Father, I'm sorry, but I can't go on being the person you want me to be. So I'm going to hurt myself before anyone else can. Love, Wally." So I covered the inquest hearing, and this was brought before the inquest hearing. The mother didn't come. The father was always there, and he had this little Bible, and it was like maybe, like this big.
Little pocket New Testament. Yeah. Right.
His thumb just constantly just circled this Bible. And I was like, oh my gosh, he has such faith. And while the university was doing their best to contribute to make it that it was really this father's fault, that it was his fault for putting so much pressure on his son to get good grades, and that while he wasn't getting good grades and he was going to be put on probation and blah, blah, blah. So the father thought that his friends pushed him out of the window. I never thought that. I always thought that, that he killed himself. And I never knew Wally. I never met him. But I thought it wasn't his father's fault. And I remember sitting out, they ruled it a suicide. The father was sitting outside on the bench, and I sat with him. And I had written all these stories, and all these records have come out of the dean and all these people trying to convince me to stop writing these articles about this kid who jumped out of the dorm. But I just felt compelled to do it, and I didn't know why then. And I remember the father was sitting, and he said, he was just crying, and he said, "I didn't cause my son to kill himself." And I said, "I don't think you did. I believe you didn't." And he just hugged me so hard. And I'm this 20-year-old kid, hugged me so hard, and he said, "Thank you." And so when all of this came out, this woman who's writing a new series of articles about it, once the priest came out, they went to the priest's house and looked up his records, and he had the original letter that Wally wrote And the letter was not to the dear father. He had erased his name. It was dear father Landwehrmeyer. And so Wally had really written his letter to the priest, not to his father, but they let his father think that. It just makes me so sad right now. Wally, when I first broke down and decided I needed help and came clean about my abuse, Wally and his dad came to me in my bed. I would wake up and it was part of my, and they would come to me and they would say, thank you, or it's out now, you know, we're done, we're at peace. And it was just so incredible. And then I had to call my friend's mother and tell her that it wasn't her fault that he committed suicide, that he was being molested, because I had never told her either. It was like that secret. His last thing he said to me was, please don't ever tell anyone, as I was walking away, that I decided it was time. So that's my story. It's a lot. I know. I'm sorry.
Wow. I'm sorry. Not at all.
On and on and on.
Not at all. So, but, no, very good. And you hit a lot of points. And like with the Catholic Church, it's part of what I call institutional abuse, because just like Michael Jackson, you don't go against the person. It's the corporation behind the person, whether it's his music making producers and all of that, that still make millions off of him, the Catholic Church behind that, you know. So you're not just
or
going
Boy
against
Scouts
the individual or Boy Scouts, right? Exactly. Or in my case, the
Methodist
Church. Yes.
Yeah. It could be anywhere.
They don't care about the individual. Yeah. They're there to protect the institution.
Yeah. And we often, I do this program now, and we often get into how do you stop this from continuing to happen. And I think you have to close the ways that people get to kids. But in my case, it just, you know, it could happen to anyone. I'm guessing that he was abused by his dad. His dad was pretty overbearing, but I doesn't excuse it, but the way I think the best way is to talk to kids, and I didn't do that with my kids, and I wish I would, but if I have grandkids, I'm going to tell them at a very young age, you come to us and you can tell us if somebody makes you feel uncomfortable, if somebody touches you in the wrong way, you always can talk to us and we will still love you. We will not judge you. If you could just have that conversation with your kids, if my parents would have that conversation with me, it probably wouldn't have lasted very long at all, if not more than just once or twice. And, you know, it lasted for 5 years. And 5 years of torment, like horror. And I couldn't, right. You know, things that happen to you where you can't go, I have to travel for my work, and I would always have to go into the hotel room, turn on all the lights, look in every corner, like I would swing open the door from the closet, look in the shower, you know, if it was a shower curtain, I'd have to open
all
it. I still hyper-vigilance. Do a little bit, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, the hypervigilant symptoms, for sure. Has that gotten any better?
It's gotten better.
Into your own healing journey now. So you have your therapist. You wrote this play. I'm sure that was cathartic about your own experiences with this issue. Congrats.
Doing the programs that we do once a month are very therapeutic, I have to say. I'm exhausted when we do each one, but it's so amazing. And I interview a lot of authors, so I always buy their book ahead of time and read it.
Right. And congratulations on that. I've noticed it's like, oh, they're actually reading it. I know I've read Doug's book, but didn't read any of Kenneth's. But I know all of his Facebook posts. I've read tons of those. And so,
books have been... Doug Carpenter, you're talking about, which is probably the best book I've ever read from a therapist. It's Secret Shame, which is so fitting for me. Right. It was fitting for me. And
right.
I just found it by accident. And it was like, I just cried so much when I was reading that book. And it was such like my Bible. But all of the survivors have different stories and different ways of telling it and different ways of healing. But we're also bonded together by what happened. And it doesn't matter. I used to think when I would read somebody's story, there's a a friend of mine who's actually playing the lead in the play, who wrote a book called Play Cars. And he was brutally raped, Nathan Slattery.
Yes. Oh, he's in your play. Oh, excellent. Yeah, he's supposed to be on this podcast. He had to cancel. He's coming on, I think, later on this month. But yes, I know Nathan. Yeah, we were both on the No Longer Ashamed podcast, and we've been on panels together there.
Well, I read his book, and I'm like, okay, so I shouldn't feel bad about what happened to me after, because what happened to him was way worse. And
it's not a contest. Went through a lot. You went through a lot yourself. So,
I can't even imagine. I mean, like when I first met Nathan, I said, I don't know if I'm talking to a ghost, because I don't know how anybody could live through what you live. His book is pretty amazing. They're all amazing. All the survivors have such amazing stories, and I find it very therapeutic to talk to them, to ask them questions, and my work with Voices Beyond Assault is very therapeutic as well. So I don't actually go to see my therapist as much as I probably should.
Yeah, ditto.
Because I'm doing a lot of work with the books and a lot of, you know, reading and things like that. My wife is like, you know, you have a whole library now of survivor and therapist books. And I'm like, yeah, but each one is just so special. And I try to get them signed if I actually meet the person I'm trying to meet, Doug. I want to meet Doug.
Very nice.
Secret Shame is like, we had to do two parts to his. We had to talk for six hours.
So much information. Yes, always. Yeah. And I don't know if you remember this, beginning of chapter two, he has two of my poems in there at the beginning of chapter two.
That's right. That's been very therapeutic for me. And you know, one of the things that my therapist had me do is write letters to my parents, my mom, my brother, because I blamed my brother for just deserting me, and my abuser, and all these people that I wrote letters to. And so then my daughter, because my wife said immediately, you have to tell the kids. And I wasn't ready, by the way. I wasn't ready to tell the kids. So my daughter, who's my middle daughter, I have two boys and two girls. She's the oldest daughter. The girls are the younger two. She came home, and I proceeded to tell her in excruciating detail, because I thought that I needed to give so much detail so that people wouldn't think badly of me, that I could, you know, that I could stop it or something like that. So it was horrific. It had to be so horrific for her, but she was so strong. And she's a writer, and she works in the movie business. And she said, I think you need to write a screenplay about this, and or a novel or something. And so I wrote a screenplay.
So how old was she when you told her?
So all my kids are in their 20s and 30s. Okay, so
she was in her 20s.
She was 27, 28. And
did she already expect stuff was going on with you? Because my kids did before I ever told them. And it's like, oh, well, that makes so much more sense. You know, they suspected with how I responded to things and so forth.
No, I was good at like Perry Power, who I don't know if you've ever met him. But,
your first podcast. Yes.
I was very good at putting a mask on. I put a mask on for everyone except my wife. She knew something was going on. I thought she would be relieved that it wasn't her, but she wasn't quite relieved at it. She understood it a little bit more, but it's something I still have to work on, right? I still have work to do. I don't think we're ever completely healed. I'm always working on it, always working on it. Now I'm reading a book so long. It's such a big book that the interview is not till May 31st, so I have some time. I'm not the quickest reader, but because I tend to remember, I read slowly, but I remember every single word that I've ever read. Wow. And that helped me in school, but it, you know, so, but
I think that's why I don't like reading so much, because I think they call it an eidetic memory. And I have a lot of that. And I remember so much about what I read. That maybe it's too much. I don't know, but I often do not enjoy reading. So,
and reading books about survivors. I tried to read a different book. So it was funny because there's this book out called by Mitch Albom. And so I read about it. It got great reviews in Wall Street Journal. So I buy this book, and it's called The Little Liar. And it's a tremendous book. I highly recommend it. But I'm sitting and reading, and my wife said, "Oh, you're reading something that's not about a survivor. Is it a happy book?" And I said, "Well, it's about the Holocaust." She's like, "Oh,
just a little light reading compared to your normal stuff." Well, before we continue, I want to remind our audience, if they have any questions for Craig, go ahead and put that in the Q&A. I know you work in Hollywood, is that right? And you've got several roles in the Hollywood world. Seems like everyone has several in that universe.
Yeah.
What do you think about the recent things going on with Drake Bell and Nickelodeon, that documentary that just popped out? I think they have another episode next week with more revelations. And then I know
I'm trying to get him on my program.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That I hope you do. I would be looking forward to.
So just recently, I've become more and more open. I don't like blurt it out the first thing I talk to people, but if I'm in a good place with people and comes up, I tell work people that what's going on, and they see my boss knows these, you know, if you Google me now, you kind of find the interviews and the different things. Yeah, just a little bit. So it's not like I'm hiding it, and I'm pretty out there now. I'm pretty open about it and open about the work that I do. So now I can use my contacts in the industry and feelings to get people on. Like I'm trying to get, also I'm talking to the guy from Full House who played Jesse.
John Stamos. He just came out as being experiencing abuse as well. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm working on getting him on the program because I think it's important for men who are famous to come forward and talk, because that helps people, right? So I know when Tyler Perry did it, it helped people tremendously. It just does. And the same with the Me Too movement for women.
Right.
As soon as some celebrities got out there, it raises awareness to the next level. So
I know Anthony really, Edwards, the guy from America's Got Talent, he's the host, does the peck dance. I can't remember his name, but yeah, he was assaulted as well, and he came out with that.
I mean, Jake Bell, when you look at the boy from Nickelodeon, Drake Brett Bell, he had a lot of issues. He had a lot of issues. Right. And then when he came forward, you're like, now it all makes sense, right? It all makes sense. Right. This is all stemming from the abuse that he had undergone. It doesn't mean he still did some horrible things. And you know, he did, you know, it made sense to me when I found that out. I was like, oh wow. Because my kids always like him because he was like kind of their era. And when my daughter called me and told me, it's like, so much sense, that just puts it all in place now. And so I think he has, I don't want to say he has a duty, I don't want to say that, but I think he has an opportunity to help other male survivors with his celebrity, and I hope he does.
Right. I've been so thrilled when other celebrities have come forward and shared their stories, and including Drake Bell most recently, that it's the power of story. And so many men need to hear, like even your story, that you, like so many, don't call it abuse right away because you don't even think of those terms. And then when someone explains it to you, and then, oh, maybe it was abuse. Oh, gosh, you mean it wasn't my fault? Even if I reacted and, you know, or pretended to be unconscious and went along with it.
Well, and sometimes I even, let's be honest, I sometimes sought it out. I mean, that's what you do. Like, okay, I want this to happen again. So let me put myself in a position where I know it can happen easily. I know there were times when I did that, and I felt guilty about that. I felt like, okay, that means I wanted it. I remember when I was taking a class, just because I saw, you always sign up for your classes, and I signed up for a class he didn't approve of me taking, and he told me to go back and get rid of that class right now. And I was like, you know, wow. And I thought I needed to do it, but I didn't do it because it was near the end. And I was like, I'm not going to, if he wants me to stop, to not take this class, then I'm going to take it. It was a journalism class.
Oh, interesting. Because then you might learn how to report on stuff, which for him would not be a good thing. So probably that makes sense why he would be against it. Yeah. Interesting. Oh, I do have something in Q&A. Let me look at that. Not a question, but thanks so much for sharing all this. I resonate with so much of this from one of our audience members. Yes. Yeah, I agree with that for sure. So what is next for you? I know sounds like you've got several on deck of podcast episodes. I wish I did, but I go out weekly. You go out monthly.
Yeah, well, you're going to be a guest. We're going to get you as a guest. And
well, I would love that.
What I co-host the program. So when after leaving Neverland, I was I joined the RAIN, the Speakers Bureau. I think you're a member too, right?
Oh, okay. I'm on a few Speakers Bureaus. So I don't think I'm on RAIN's yet.
So I was on the Speakers Bureau, and this woman, where they were asked us to panel. I was always the token male on the panel. There'd be one male and then five females or whatever, four females. Right. And they asked this woman, they asked all of us, what do you do to relieve stress? She said pole dancing, and I just started laughing because my day, pole dancing wasn't exercise, you know, it was something else. Right. So I was like, I just thought she was joking, right? And she wasn't. She wasn't joking. It's actually right, part of her therapy. And so afterwards, she called me and she said, I'm having a retreat with my group. Will you come? It's in Santa Barbara. And I'm like, yeah, I'll come. And I was in crutches. I had broken my foot. So I was in crutches, but I went. And I was so nervous about going. I never had met another survivor in person. Never met another survivor. And so I got there and I look around. It's a beautiful place, but I only see women. And I'm like, what am I going to do here? And then all of a sudden she comes out. Her name is Brianna. She's the founder of Voices Beyond Soul. She comes and she gives me the biggest hug and she says, I'm so glad you're here. And then all of a sudden, all these men came out of the woodwork. They just came and we just got into a group. And I remember there was this younger guy and Lane Lorward, and he's my co-host on the, program. And he was like 24. And I'm like, oh my God, this is so great that you could come forward at such a young age. You didn't wait as long as me, you know, hiding your shame and keeping up this fake persona. You came forward, and I think that's so great. And I would like you to do a program with me so that we could show the two age groups, you know, me who had to hide it for all my life, and you who could come free. And I think we would bring something very unique together. And so we've done it for over a year now, and we just did our 12th month. It's very fulfilling. It's great. And I love his perspective because it's different than mine. And so we kind of play off of each other. It works out really well. So that I will continue doing the play. We're doing the reading this Saturday with a professional cast who are very dedicated, and of which Nathan, who's a survivor, is the lead playing me, which is sort of playing a character that was based on me.
Does he go to an American accent? Because I know he does. Australia or New Zealand? Yes.
I offered to write it as like, say, you know, he said, no, I do a great American accent. And he does. He pulls it off really well. No one would ever know. He's an Aussie, and then when we get to the question and answer, he just talks in his accent. But this cast really is dedicated to wanting to bring this to life. By the way, I just need to show it off. My daughter, who I told my story to, she gave me this, and I've never taken it off in 6.5 years, and it says strength. And she gave it to me after I told her my story. And
so just to describe it to our podcast listeners who don't have the video, circle.
All it is it's
like a giant O.
It's like a washer, a big washer.
Right. I was thinking that too.
And
yeah.
That's how thick it is. And it says strength on it. Nice. It's like wearing out. You can actually see that it's wearing out, but I don't know what I'm going to do when it wears out because I don't take it off. I sleep with it. It's always part of me because it gives you strength, right? To have people, the community of survivors gives me strength. The people that work hard to understand survivors give me strength. The people who aren't survivors who are dedicating their lives to helping survivors through as therapists and psychoanalysts and things. I just met with one who has written an amazing book. She's going to be a guest, Sarah Van Gogh in London. Those people give me strength. It's a lot of great things. And I feel like I'm in a really good place now. This play is coming out. We're trying to get it to be a full-blown production. But just even like we'll have an audience of like 50 or 60 people this Saturday. And it's a lot of people I know. And, you know, it's pretty out there. Nathan helped me, if you've read his book, which you should, but his book was so brutally honest, and I think that my stage play wasn't quite, I was holding back a little bit, and he got me to open up even more. It made the play so much better. So I credit him and my daughter, who wrote a lot of it with me as well. It's amazing getting it out there. And I think what it does mostly is I always decided from the very start that I was going to work to make it so that other survivors didn't have to wait 30, 40 years before they, or even longer, before they got help. I don't want people to wait that long. I want people to be like Lorwood, where they can come forward immediately. Right. Like, I mean, it took them like 8 months, but 8 months compared to 50, 40 years, it's like not
and
much.
And you can get so much healing. And there's so much healing out there now that there wasn't available back when we were that age.
Just in the last 5 years, Mike, there's just been so much in the last 5 years, so much great things in the last 5 years that give me so much hope. I pretty much feel that if you do the work and you want to be healed, you can be healed and you can move on and you can be productive and not go into drugs or suicidal thoughts or things like that, depression. I think that it is possible. I know it's possible. And by the way, I talk about this a lot too. My faith has been very much a part of my healing. It still is. He was my only friend. He was my only person. He's the only reason I'm here today. He's the only reason that rope broke. I know it. I know he's the reason. I knew it as soon as I came to, that he was the reason, that he had a plan, that he didn't want me to end things that way.
Right.
And he gave me the strength.
He sure did. Wonderful. Any other final thoughts? We'll have your contact information in the show notes for all that you do, including that wonderful podcast that, I've enjoyed listening to. I've caught up with all the episodes. Any final thoughts?
And I think it's so amazing the work you're doing and the work that Drew's doing. I mean, so many people, and Doug, and everybody that's doing things, and people say, are there competing podcasts? No, there cannot be enough podcasts. There can't be enough programs out in the world about this. We need to paper the world with this. So I think the biggest message that I would have survivors, and I do ask this to people, is that, you know, I always say you're not alone and it's a journey, but it's worthwhile and it can be a new beginning. At the end of the play, the last line is, this is the end of our story, but it's just the beginning.
I love that.
Because he tells his wife for the first time at the end of the story, and she's about to leave him, and he tells her, "You don't know what's going to happen, just like you never know what's going to happen." She just turns to him, and that's when the stage goes black. You have a feeling that he's going to be okay.
Right. Wow. That's great. Thank you so much, Craig, for your story and coming here today. That's it. Well, if you would like to join us in future episodes, again, polarlabconsulting.com/live. We'll see you all next week. If you would like to learn more about my coaching with Polar Live Consulting, where I provide one-on-one coaching and group coaching, both with a focus on healing for male survivors, reach out to me at polarliveconsulting.com. That is polar, spelled P-O-L-A-R. I would love to hear from you. I want to hear your story. If you would like your story featured on this podcast, contact me via my website. If you like this podcast, please rate and review, because that's how other people can find me, and I really want to spread this message of healing and hope to others. And remember, you are not alone. Healing is possible, and the abuse was not your fault. Let me repeat that. The abuse was not your fault. See you next time on the Healing for Male Survivors podcast.